Hello, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of October 1st, 2010. Can it really be October already? Well, it is, and if you're in the mood to be spooked, I have one word for you: retirement. We'll talk to a retirement company CEO who says you can change your retirement picture if you're a little behind these days. And if you're feeling like the economy is on the mend and you'd like to ask the boss about that raise he's been putting off, make sure your messaging is appropriate.
So you don't want to talk about your mortgage payment or the fact that you're now sending another kid to college. That's not relevant to the employer's business.
And with the cost of college soaring, find out why some parents choose not to save for school.
We got these kids who have a good sense of the world. We invested in children, not in retirement accounts and college accounts.
Those stories and more are coming up. But first, perhaps it's time to retire the idea of retirement. A report out this week from MetLife says the first wave of baby boomers already find themselves redefining what retirement means. And what it means is more work. They can't retire because they haven't saved enough money. But across the pond in Britain, another survey has identified an altogether different phenomenon. It's called never-tirement. Wealthy workers who can well afford early retirement are postponing it indefinitely, by choice. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Ah, retirement. A chance to take it easy at last after 40 years or more of toil. But it's not a prospect that appeals to 67-year-old entrepreneur Dick Pyle. He sold his stake in a successful London restaurant 9 years ago, decamped to the French countryside like a lot of British retirees. Except Dick now runs another thriving business.
Hello, Truffletree, can I help you?
He's built up a profitable company in France called Truffletree, growing that fungal delicacy. Retirement couldn't be further from his mind.
I don't know what I'd do if I retired. I mean, people just sit around and drink or play golf. It's not how I wanted to spend the rest of my life, really.
Dick is a never-tiree, one of a fast-growing breed identified in a recent report by private banking group Barclays Wealth. Greg Davies helped compile the survey.
There's an overwhelming trend for wealthy people to say that they fully intend to continue working, being involved in productive activity, well after what we might think of as the standard retirement age.
Barclays surveyed 2,000 people with at least $1.5 million to invest. To the bank's surprise, more than half of those polled in the US and the UK said they'll give retirement a miss. And these were not always the restless, driven, go-getting type.
It's not true only of those entrepreneurs who have built up their own businesses. It seems to be equally true across our entire sample, including people who are wealthy because they have inherited their wealth.
Among those determined to carry on working until they drop, doctors, lawyers and economists.
I'm Andrew Hilton. I'm the director of the Center for the Study of Financial Innovation, and I'm 63.
Only 2 years to go then before Andrew could slip into well-heeled and well-deserved retirement. But, says Andrew, forget it. He's soldiering on.
Unfortunately, perhaps, my job and my life have become so intertwined that I can't really envisage not working.
And that is the key to this urge to carry on working, even among people who can easily afford to retire. Sarah Harper is Professor of Gerontology at Oxford University.
People get a lot more out of work. They get status, they feel that they are making a contribution, they network, there's a purpose in their life. And I think, therefore, the reason why we increasingly are finding people saying, actually, I'd like to stay on, is because of all those other factors, not just the financial ones.
And there's another major consideration, life expectancy. Retire at 60 and you could easily face up to 30 years of pottering around the golf course or chilling out beside the pool. Now that sounds like really hard work. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace Money.
For those of you who are most definitely not in the never-tirement camp, the question is whether you'll ever have enough money to stop working. Just about every survey done on retirement planning shows we as a nation simply do not save enough. Roger Ferguson knows that as well as anybody. He's the CEO of TIAA CREF, the largest private retirement system in the country with nearly $400 billion in assets. I and my colleague Kai Rizdahl recently sat down with Ferguson at TIAA CREF headquarters in Midtown Manhattan to talk about the future of retirement in the wake of the Great Recession. We're here on the roof of your building on a beautiful sunny day. Tell us a little bit about what we're looking at here.
Okay. We're looking at a number of the famous buildings. Right over your shoulder, Tess, is a building. It's now called the MetLife Building. Mm-hmm. It used to be the Pan Am Building. We can also see from here J.P. Morgan Chase. And then we have that way, that Citibank building right there.
And I believe way over my right shoulder we have the Empire State Building.
And there is exactly right. The antenna from the Empire State Building right down there.
Well, you've painted a picture for us of our surroundings here. I wonder if you would paint a picture for us of the retirement outlook today. Are we saving enough?
The answer is the retirement outlook for many people is uncertain. Most Americans probably are not saving enough. More importantly, though, this crisis has shown the vulnerabilities of the retirement system. We have seen 401ks collapse. It's a very sad and painful joke that 401ks have gone to 201ks.
Right.
Maybe they've come back to 301ks. Not very funny for the people who've lived through that. And then the other leg of the retirement stool, Social Security, that's also under a lot of stress. And so we have a number of challenges in the retirement world right now, not just that we're not saving enough, but that almost every element of the retirement system is under stress or has come under question.
You made a speech at the National Press Club a number of months ago in which you said we are at a pivotal moment in retirement security in this country. How do we make that pivot? I mean, we know the problems the recession and the financial crisis have brought. Now what do we do?
I think in order to make that pivot, Kai, we need to really have a plan. We need to adopt what I describe as a retirement system for the 21st century and be quite clear about what we're doing. First, obviously, we have to have more people in positions where they can save, which is to say get people started saving earlier, get them into retirement systems automatically. Secondly, we do have to tell them how much they need to save. And retirement economists tell us that at this stage, if you want to replace 70 to 80% of your pre-retirement income, you probably need to be saving somewhere around 10 to 14%. The third element is an appropriate range of investment options. 15 to 20 is what most professionals tell us is called for.
Is there something about people in this country that, you know, I mean, we all have expenses and many people have lost their jobs and this has been an incredibly difficult time, but we have been non-savers in this country for a long time.
No, you make a very good point, right? We are in the midst of a very slow recovery from a very deep recession, there's no question. But even in the best of times, I think people did not save enough.
For the people who did save, though, you know, one of the common themes running through your plan is that we are all very much now responsible for figuring out our own numbers. The demise of the pension has really meant that it's up to us to try to figure out what to do with the money that we do set aside for retirement. I wonder if we could get your thoughts on whether we are able to handle that responsibly.
Well, Tess, you put your finger on a very important point. One of the other things that is an important part of the system is to get good advice, objective advice from, you know, a trusted expert, because handling one's retirement is, as you point out, relatively complex. We also, though, have to make sure that people are well-educated. So it's a combination of learning a bit more, increasing the level of financial literacy in the country, while also providing as much objective and non-commissioned advice as we possibly can find.
Who handles your retirement?
All of my retirement money is managed by my company at TIAA CREF, and I've got four very good advisors, actually. I'm not sure everyone needs that.
There are so many demands on our savings time, though, right? There are so many things we have to save for. Somebody told me once that what you ought to do is think about it like you think about it in an airplane when you're traveling with a kid and the stewardess comes by and says, with the oxygen mask, drop down, take care of yourself first, and then take care of the kid. So basically, you've got college accounts, and you've got retirement, and you've got all sorts of other things. Prioritize for me how people ought to start thinking about that stuff.
Well, look, first recognize that they're not necessarily in conflict. There are, as you say, priorities. I think one always has to put a little something aside for retirement, even as you're paying for your mortgage, paying for your children's education. And you recognize that as those other demands on your savings go away, you should increase what you're saving for retirement.
I wonder if you'd be willing to answer a couple of questions directly from our listeners. We solicited, told them that we were going to be talking to you. Nathan Bishop of Albuquerque, New Mexico, wrote in and said, It seems to me that many people get stars in their eyes about double-digit returns and early retirement. You know, I'm out of here at 58, 59. How does your company talk people out of taking inappropriate risks and maybe guide them to a more achievable goal?
Right. The first thing that we do is we have a very serious conversation with them about their own risk appetite, and we try to broaden that conversation so that they understand both the ups and the downs. Secondly, we look at their entire portfolio so that we understand the assets they have with us and assets they may have other places. And then we do something very important, which is we do a modeling of the likely retirement outcome with various different scenarios so they can then understand the stars in their eyes may not come to reality. And out of that, I think they get brought back to earth, if you will.
And from our Facebook page, Tom Coach wrote in and wanted to know, how do you know how much you will need to retire? He is worried about not only undersaving, but oversaving. And you can go with every calculator in the book and still not know how long you're going to live, for example, you know?
No,
which is
really?
A question
Come on,
they ask you that question in the calculators, you know?
A couple of things. One is most people should assume that they're going to probably live 20 to 30 years in retirement, which is not very concrete, obviously, because it varies from person to person. You're absolutely right. At the end of the day, the calculators can give you a range of answers. That's why we also say to people, well, you should think about replacing 70 to 80% of your pre-retirement income, because that really, I think, targets people in on a number. And then the other thing that we've seen is, sadly, very few people seem to be over-saving for retirement. The McKinsey study that I most recently saw showed that the average American may be short of retirement savings by something like $250,000. And so while there may be a small handful who are over-saving, it looks as though the vast majority probably aren't saving enough.
Roger Ferguson, President and CEO of TIAA CREF, thanks for joining us up on the roof.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
And to hear our entire conversation with Roger Ferguson, including the version that aired on our sister show Marketplace, go to marketplace.org. Want to save money, the environment, and indulge your inner geek all at the same time?
I learned to turn lights off and replace light bulbs with high-efficiency light bulbs, and that you don't need the hot tub on constant filter at 130 degrees.
There are gadgets galore, but it's up to you to change your habits. That story's later on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and it is the time in the show where we take your money questions. Here with me is our good friend Liz Pulliam Weston.
Hi, Tess.
She writes the personal finance column for MSN. And it is the first weekend of October, so allow me to be the first to say happy holidays.
Thank you, Tess. It's not too early to start decorating. Let's go for it.
You know, I've been seeing a lot about holiday planning, both on the travel front and also on the, you know, how you prepare for a pretty expensive time of year front. Any basic advice?
Well, if you are traveling this season, you want to make your reservations now. I've been telling people from my blog and on my Facebook fan page, this is the time to do it, because what we have is pent-up demand. Mm-hmm. There are people who put off going back for the holidays a couple years, and grandma's getting mad.
Right.
So we have fewer seats. We have more competition for those seats. So you're not going to be waiting and then getting some great deal at the last minute.
Okay. And preparing your budget for
the holidays? Yes. I've had
some
ritual. My readers say, oh, you can't possibly be talking about this now. But, you know, you've got a few weeks to prepare, a couple months. And if you spread those costs out and start saving, you can actually get ahead. And I have this, I must admit, Excel spreadsheet.
Oh, Liz.
It's true. I'm a geek. I admit it. But you know what? helps me keep track. And there's a lot of different factors. We got the gifts, we got the decorations, we got the travel, we got the entertaining, and my spreadsheet just helps me keep track of what the budget is. And I mentioned that on Facebook, and then a bunch of my readers said, oh, I want that. So I posted it up for them. So you can use it too.
All right. So go visit Liz and her spreadsheet. Is there anything you don't have a spreadsheet for in your budget?
I have to think about that.
All right, well, let's get to the phones. And it looks like I should mention that our first caller here will be getting the Getting Personal Distance Award. Andrew is with us from, is it Misawa, Japan?
Yes.
Misawa. Where exactly is that?
It is the north part of Honshu, the Big Island.
Okay. So then I presume it's safe to say you catch us on the podcast.
Yes.
All right. Well, what do you do there in Japan?
I'm in the Air Force.
Wow. How long have you been doing that?
I went to the Air Force Academy in 98, and I've been a commissioned active duty officer since 2002.
What do you fly?
I fly F-16s.
F-16s. All right, describe what that's like for us, for those of us who will never, ever be in that cockpit.
It's pretty awesome. The jet's unbelievable. It's difficult to describe, I guess. It is definitely a dream job. It's the best office in the world, that's for sure.
Yeah, I bet. And do you have family on base?
Yeah, my wife is here, and then the birth of our first child just happened about a month ago.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Well, that's terrific. So are we starting to think about a college plan then?
Yes. So the big issue is whether I do a 529, a Coverdale, or a combination of both.
Oh, boy. Okay. Well, let's start with a quick definition, Liz, of each of those, Coverdale.
Yes. The Coverdale is kind of like a education IRA. That's what it used to be called. Mm-hmm. And you put money into it. And right now, you can use that money for college expenses or kindergarten through 12th grade expenses.
Oh, okay.
With a 529 college savings plan, the money is intended for college.
Okay. Any other big differences between the two?
The Coverdale, you're basically doing the investing yourself. You can choose, you know, any brokerage, any mutual fund you want. When you go with the 529 college savings plan, you pick a state's plan.
Right.
And you may have some options within that, but you are more restricted in terms of, you know, how often you can change investment options and when you can put the money in.
Okay. Well, Liz, do you have a recommendation of one or the other?
Well,
both?
Let me ask, why would you be attracted to the Coverdale? What about it appeals to you?
Sometimes in the military, overseas schools are very good, but sometimes when we go to stateside bases, the schools, depending on where we're located, can be pretty good or pretty bad.
Yeah.
And so my concern is making sure if I'm assigned someplace where the schools are not so good, to make sure my daughter has a good education, whether that be a private institution or maybe some like additional tutoring. So that's why the Coverdale kind of appeals to me.
Okay, well, I have some bad news and some good news. And the bad news is that what you like about the Coverdale is about to go away.
Uh-oh.
Okay.
Yeah. The ability to use the money for kindergarten through 12th grade expenses is something that's supposed to sunset on December 31st. And so far, Congress hasn't indicated it's going to extend that. The other thing that changes is that right now you can put $2,000 a year into a Coverdale. That's going to drop to $500.
$500?
Yeah. So the good news is that makes your decision a little simpler. You know, you can look at a 529 college savings plan, and I encourage you to because, you know, college expenses are huge. And if you start putting $200 a month now into her 529, you have a good chance of having enough money to pay for a public school education, at least a public college. If you can put some more, you can also have private school as an option. But since you're concerned as well about the private school expenses, you can also just open an account on your own. You know, one of the nice things about opening a brokerage account, a taxable brokerage account, is you can control the tax bill. If you hang on to your investments long enough, you qualify for favorable capital gains. You know, you might not pay much of, if anything, in taxes as it grows. And then when you're ready to sell, you get that, you know, favorable tax treatment. So that can work out pretty well.
Okay.
Andrew, how does it work for children of the military, particularly if you're in a place like Japan? Do you have is there a standard school where they would send your child, or is it always a private school? How does that work?
There's the Department of Defense Dodd School, and it's actually a really, really good school. And then you always have the option to put your son or daughter into the local schools, which actually is a pretty popular thing in Japan. The schools are pretty good.
Hmm. So what do you think you'll do? I mean, does it sound worth it to go ahead with the Coverdale, even with the restrictions that sound like they're kind of come back?
Well, the more I hear about it and the more that I hear that a lot of the things that were beneficial seem like they're going to expire as far as the benefits are concerned,
yeah.
I'll probably go with a 529 and then maybe just a separate account where I'm just putting money into mutual funds that I can withdraw
right.
anytime I want and can and use those for education later.
Yeah.
That actually gives you the most flexibility because then you can decide what is a qualified education expense. And if it turns out she doesn't need the money for K through 12 expenses, then you can use it for whatever you want. There's no restrictions when it's your own money in a taxable account.
You know, Liz, the one question that we get quite often from people about the 529 plan is how do you go about picking which one to do? You know, because you basically can kind of go with whatever state you deem fit,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, the first place I send people is to Morningstar because they do a list of the best and worst plans. If you get a tax break, if you're in a state that gives you a tax break for investing in your own state's funds, you want to take a close look at that, but don't necessarily opt for that just automatically because some states' plans are really expensive and even the tax break is not going to offset yeah. that.
And of course, Andrew is not in a state.
Exactly.
So. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, Andrew, does that help you out?
It does. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your service and enjoy your time there in Japan.
Oh, it's been an awesome tour, and thank you guys for the great show.
All right. Take care.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. All right. Let's go next to Nathaniel from my hometown, Portland, Oregon. Hi,
oh.
Nathaniel.
Hi there. I'm Nathaniel Hard. Yeah, I listen to Marketplace on KOPB 91.5.
Excellent. That's where I started my career. Well, Nathaniel, I understand that, like Andrew, you've got a pretty interesting job. Tell us what you do.
I'm an archaeologist, actually, so I'm kind of in the middle of nowhere most of the time.
Wow. Now, in the middle of nowhere, are you in the middle of Oregon, or do you travel around?
Right now, I'm in Lakeview, Oregon, but usually I bounce around a lot. I've worked in Utah, Idaho, Washington, Oregon, Colorado.
Huh. What's the coolest thing you've ever dug up?
Coolest thing I ever found was on a crew, we found a conch shell, you know, like an abalone shell that had
yeah.
been cut down and made into an incense bearer, and that was in rural Utah, far eastern Utah.
Cut down and made into a what?
An incense bearer. For ceremony purposes, they burn incense in it.
Wow.
It's a long way to go by foot.
Wow. Now, how can you tell that that's what it was used for?
We know the shape of those things. It looked just like other instances that we found.
Yeah.
And, the way that it was processed, we know, was pretty archaic. So.
Wow. That's really cool.
So were you the kid who was always digging stuff up in the backyard?
Yeah, I was. my first dig, I was about probably 5 years old, and I actually found a brickyard that used to be in our old backyard.
Did you really?
Came back with little plastic baggies full of bricks from the 1920s.
That's really cool.
And Mom says,
thanks. Could you fill in the hole when you're done?
All right. Well, I don't know. Are we helping you out? Are we carbon dating your finances? Is that what we're doing here?
Well, there wouldn't be much evidence to date there.
Uh-oh.
So in my profession, it's mostly contract work. You bounce around a lot, as you can see from the states I've worked in. And so there's usually not health insurance and no employee-sponsored IRA, 401k, no pension, no nothing like that.
So you're doing all that on your own?
Yeah, that's all out of pocket. And I usually end up with maybe about $100 that I could throw into savings. But ultimately, the only thing that I have that I can count on for sure every year is my tax return. And I found out recently about a program where you can put your tax return directly into an iSavings bond.
Yep.
I was curious about doing that as a means of saving for retirement, because it's something I can count on every year.
Right.
I'm a little cautious about anything tied to the market because I really don't know much about money. And I do know that a lot of people lost a lot of pensions, a lot of retirement the past couple of years. So,
yeah. Well, Liz, first of all, your thoughts on I-bonds?
Well, they are a decent, very low return, low risk investment. And that's what concerns me, is that you're not going to make a lot of money there. And Nathaniel, how old are you?
I'm 27.
27. Okay. You probably have 40 years until full retirement age. And 40 years is a heck of a long time. And what's going to happen is that, you know, those I bonds are going to, you know, keep you about the same, but they're not going to offer you any real growth. So you have to save a heck of a lot more money to have the same nest egg as somebody who's willing to take some risk in the stock market.
But there are so many people right now, particularly young people,
oh, yeah,
who all they know now is what happened in 2008.
Yeah.
And they're like, I'm done.
Nope. Don't want to face that. And yeah, I totally understand that. The good news is that that will make them hopefully more cautious going forward, so they won't be falling for this idea that they can have 100% in stocks and, you know, just
right,
gut it out, because yeah, very few people can stand that kind of risk. But I don't want to see them go the other way and totally give up on the market, because that's where you get the kind of returns that can help you grow your money over time. Maybe in something like a target date fund, where all the heavy lifting is done for you. They're choosing the investment, and over time it gets more conservative, so that you can learn more about the market, get more comfortable, and then make more of your own decisions.
So, Nathaniel, given what Liz has said, do you think that you might have any change of heart on regarding Wall Street?
I don't know. I do know that right now, you know, the market's pretty down right now, so it really can't go too much further down.
Well, I don't know about that, actually.
But 40 years is a long time to go
it
back
is
up.
Yes.
It is.
Yeah, you have a lot of time to recoup anything that drops. And if the only way you are comfortable is putting it in I bonds, then you have my blessing. I just want you to get started. So you've got to get in the habit of putting money aside for retirement and then ease into, you know, some riskier investments as you feel more comfortable with it.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call, Nathaniel.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, if you've got a money question that you would like to uncover, dig up, we'll be your Indiana Jones. Our voicemail is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or better yet, send us an email through the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Liz, and finally we have Tina, and she is in Durham, North Carolina. Hi, Tina.
Hi.
Tell us how you catch the show there in Durham, North Carolina.
I listen to WNC in Chapel Hill.
All right. And what do you do there?
I am an English teacher. I teach World Lit and American Lit, and then occasional senior electives.
What kind of senior electives?
My one for this year is called Madness in Literature, Art, and Film.
Ah! Ooh, fun!
We're going to read Heart of Darkness, oh, watch Apocalypse Now, and Psycho, oh, and
wow,
cool things like that.
I want to take your class.
Yeah, no kidding.
It's a lot of fun.
Well, what can we help you out with today?
Well, my husband and I are refinancing our house, and we discovered in that process of sort of shopping around a little bit for a mortgage, several different people said to us, gosh, you're paying a lot for homeowners insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody seemed to sort of have their suggested person
right,
for us to talk to about it. But we went with one who did indeed find us a better deal. And then she came up with this idea, if you want to get an umbrella liability policy for $1 million, it would only cost you $238, so you could still be better off financially than you were before in terms of the outlay and also in the coverage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's where we're wondering, okay, yeah, it's not a terrible price for that much insurance and stuff, but do we really need it?
All right. Well, Liz, give us an idea of what umbrella coverage is and what it covers.
Yeah, it's actually very descriptive. It's a policy that sits over your other policies like an umbrella. And mm-hmm, typically what you need to do is get the maximum amount of liability insurance from your homeowners and your auto, which could be $250,000, $300,000, $500,000. And then once that's exhausted, you know, if something bad happens, mm-hmm, then the umbrella policy kicks in. And liability insurance is what protects you if someone sues you or someone gets hurt on your property or you cause an accident. So that's what liability insurance is for.
So the umbrella coverage is, it just gives you more.
It gives you more. And you may think, do I really need this? Well, I like to see people have liability insurance in general at least equal to their net worth, mm-hmm, preferably 2 times their net worth. You know, that gives you some protection. You don't lose everything if something awful should happen. And, you know, as Tina says, the price is right.
Yeah.
It's 230 or 300 bucks, whatever it is.
Is that 230 a year or a month?
Should be 230 a year, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Wow, that sounds like a deal.
It is.
So what do you think, Tina? Can you handle $230 a year?
You know, I haven't looked at net worth for a long time. We should probably go back and sort of look at that for a number of different reasons.
Yeah, certainly
but
a good start.
It is certainly helpful to kind of, this is more clarity than I've had as I've pondered it. So yeah. I really appreciate it.
Well, and, you know, Liz, I think people, whenever they are dealing with insurance, there's just this hesitation because you're so worried about getting sold a bill of goods.
Exactly.
Getting sold something that you really don't need because of the history of insurance.
Well, and hopefully you will never need this.
I mean,
this is one of those policies that, you know, you hope to go through your whole life and never use it, because that means if you are using it, something horrible has happened. But for $20 a month, you know, I don't want to sound like an insurance salesman. I do not sell insurance. To me, the $20 a month is a great kind of wrapper to wrap around yourself and know that you're protected if something awful did happen.
Okay.
Great question. Thanks for the call.
You bet.
Bye-bye. Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we've got. But if you have a question, let us know about it. Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or send us an email through the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Liz, thanks so much. As always, it's been fun.
It's been a pleasure, Tess. Thanks.
And do remember to talk to your own financial professional before making any big money decisions. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. The end of the fiscal year marked the end of a $5 billion stimulus program that subsidized more than 200,000 low-income jobs all over the country. Many of those workers will now return to the unemployment line. Meanwhile, those who've been lucky enough to have and keep their jobs are wondering when workplace austerity might end. All those slashed benefits and postponed raises. Allison Green writes the blog Ask a Manager. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So basically, there seems to have been kind of a mantra over the last year or two that, you know what, you're just lucky to have a job. Don't go asking for raises and all kinds of extras at this point. Would you agree that that's been the ethos?
That is the ethos that most employees have in their heads. I'm not sure that it reflects the reality of what it's actually okay to ask for.
So even in a recession, you would say don't be shy?
You don't want to be super aggressive, but asking for a raise when you haven't had one for a year or more, or asking to work at home occasionally when you need to concentrate, or asking for a flexible schedule because you need to pick your kid up from daycare, these are things that have always been reasonable. They're still reasonable. That's not the sort of thing that you're going to get shown the door for asking about. They might not say yes, but there's no harm in asking.
Well, you might not get shown the door, but at a time when so many people lost their jobs, you know, people watched colleagues having to walk out the door with no income in sight. How do you go in and ask for a raise?
It's important to know what your manager is likely thinking. If you're a good employee, your manager is looking to keep you happy within reason. And you want to think like a manager rather than like an employee. And that means build a business case for what you're presenting. Explain how your proposal would benefit the business, not just yourself. And also explain how you would mitigate any negatives. In the case of something like flex time, mitigating the negatives might mean laying out exactly how you're going to make sure this doesn't inconvenience your coworkers and so forth.
Well, then let me ask you point blank about the raise then. Has this been a time for anyone to be asking for raises?
You know, there are people still asking for and receiving raises. It might be harder to get a yes, but you've got to know your context. You have to know what's going on at your company. Timing matters. You don't want to make a request for a raise when your company has just received bad financial news or is in the middle of layoffs or frankly, even just when your manager is in a bad mood. You want to be sensitive to timing. You want to bring some emotional intelligence to it. It's not crazy to ask to be compensated for the value of the work you're providing.
What kinds of questions are you seeing from your readers when it comes to making requests of the boss?
People write to me all the time saying, you know, my company put a salary freeze in effect a couple of years ago. I'm really underpaid for my industry, and I'd like to ask for more, but is that crazy to do?
But you're saying that actually they have more options than they think they do.
Particularly if they're a good employee. If you're not that great, all bets are off. I probably can't help you.
But you probably don't think of yourself as a not-so-great employee.
There's the problem. But, you know, if you're really good, you know that you're really good. You see yourself racking up results. You're getting positive feedback. If you are someone who is in that position where you can tell that your manager and your employer seem thrilled to have you there, you have more leverage than you think you have. They really don't want to have to replace you.
And what's the best way to then come prepared? How do you even approach telling your boss why you want to meet?
I would be straightforward. I would say, it's been 2 years since my last salary increase, and I want to talk to you about what we can do moving forward, and I have some proposals that I want to run by you. I always encourage people to keep a running list of triumphs as they happen, because often you won't remember 6 months down the road that you did something really fantastic back in March or whenever it was. And when you come to your boss, you can lay out a professional, business-based case for why your value to the employer has gone up. What you don't want to do is make the case about your own personal needs. You don't want to talk about your mortgage payment or the fact that you're now sending another kid to college. That's not relevant to the employer's business. You want to explain how it will benefit them, how it makes sense for them.
All right, Allison Green, thanks so much for your help.
Thank you very much for having me.
Allison writes the Ask a Manager blog, and you can find her tips for getting what you want at work at marketplace.org. It is October, and while most kids would say that means only one thing, Halloween! In fact, there's something else almost as terrific, Energy Awareness Month. The first President Bush started the whole thing 19 years ago to help reduce energy consumption. More recently, power companies started testing new gadgets aimed at helping their customers do just that. They're called smart meters. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sarah Gardner explores whether they're actually changing our energy usage.
Bob Simon confesses that before his utility recruited him for a pilot project, he was clueless about his energy use.
I just paid my bill, plain and simple. I figured it was normal for a family of four to have a bill of that size.
$344 a month on average for gas and electric. In recent months, though, this Oshkosh, Wisconsin car salesman has cut his utility bill in half. He says that's because he started using free electricity tracking software from Google. It's called PowerMeter. The local utility, Wisconsin Public Service, has about 100 customers testing it out.
We're looking at a graph of 2 days and the amount of power per hour that's used on a bar graph.
Simon can check that bar graph on his iGoogle page. There's a 24-hour delay in the data, and it doesn't tell Simon exactly why his power use goes up or down. But he says now he's more aware of how he wastes energy. He did a little homework as a result and broke some long-time habits.
I learned to turn lights off and replace light bulbs with high-efficiency light bulbs, and that you don't need the hot tub on constant filter at 130 degrees when you use it twice a month.
Simon also learned to ratchet down the heat on weekdays when nobody was home except the family dog. Same for the air conditioner in the summer. No comfort sacrificed, Simon says, and he enjoys his monster flat-screen TV all the more, knowing he's saving energy elsewhere.
Wisconsin has very long winters. You're not going to go running in the winter because it's 30 below. You're going to sit in here under a blanket and watch television.
So here we go. This is a live look with your WeatherBug network, and you can see the temps in Fond du Lac and Neenah.
Lots of companies are now selling either home energy software or small monitors with digital screens that tell consumers how much power they're using and the costs. Corporate giants like Microsoft and GE have both jumped into this business, and venture capitalists are enthusiastically funding a bumper crop of startups like Tendril and EcoDog. Question is, do most consumers want what they're selling? Greg Guthridge is an expert on this new industry at Accenture.
We're finding that in-home devices appeal to a small segment of active consumers who have sort of propensity for green or for economic savings and also have a lot of discretionary time.
Some studies project these products could cut home electricity use by up to 15%, but none of them have been around long enough to pass the kitchen drawer test, as in how long before the novelty wears off and they end up in the junk pile. This past spring, Commonwealth Edison in Chicago mailed 2,500 customers free in-home energy monitors made by Tendril. Less than a third of them have turned them on. And then there's the PR problem.
we're finding a significant number of consumers and a growing part of the population that views these devices as some kind of a big brother or some kind of a control mechanism.
But even if utilities do manage to win their customers' trust, it's not clear that giving them more data will lead them to slash their power use, even if that data is up to the minute and includes prices.
The reason is that energy is extremely inexpensive.
George Lowenstein is a professor of economics and psychology at Carnegie Mellon University.
In Pittsburgh, if you use a 5,000 BTU air conditioner for an hour, it costs you 4 cents.
Lowenstein says to make a serious impact long-term on nationwide energy use, average electricity prices have to go way up.
As a society, we're missing the forest for the trees. We're focusing on these kind of palliatives, like giving people information. And sometimes I worry that these palliatives are coming at the expense of more fundamental change, like adjusting electricity prices to reflect the true costs of the energy to society.
Like air pollution and global warming. But with a U.S. carbon tax nowhere near in sight, you can expect more home energy gizmos and software, not less. And perhaps more people like Bob Simon, who sees these smart energy tools as smart for his bottom line.
Who's not for saving money? You don't have to save the world. You're saving money. You're helping yourself.
In Oshkosh, Wisconsin, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace Money.
So Energy Awareness Month started just as College Savings Month drew to a close. So if you're a parent and you just didn't get around to starting that 529 plan, well, I guess it's too late. I joke. I kid. Relax. You're actually in good company. Plenty of people don't save a dime for their kids' college. Intentionally. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Amy Scott reports.
Another school day has ended in Perry, Georgia, south of Macon. Celestin Webb pulls a long yellow school bus past Pecan Farms and into her driveway. She parks on the lawn. Webb calls driving the bus her get-out-of-debt job.
Our goal was to get out of debt before Tesla started college. We started at $58,000 in credit card and car debt, and we're down to $14,600.
Tesla, the oldest of four daughters, starts college next year. The Webbs may be debt-free by then, but they haven't saved a cent to pay for college.
Nope, absolutely nothing.
Webb says she and her husband had to pay their way through school. She worked one, two, sometimes three jobs at once.
We painted, we cleaned out a refrigerator at a fraternity one summer because it had gotten the power cut and all the meat was rotted. And we just did whatever we could do to make extra money. And I believe that I valued my education very highly because of that.
She wants the same for her kids.
I think one of the gifts that we give our children is work. I felt like I was a good success as a parent when my little girl came to me and said, Mommy, Mommy, can I have a dollar job because it's Tesla's birthday and I want to buy her a present? And she didn't ask me for money. She asked me for a job.
But odd jobs don't go as far as they used to. Tesla will need some financial aid. Lynn O'Shaughnessy writes the College Solution blog. She's all for kids paying a share of their education, but she says the problem with letting them go it completely alone is that the people who give out financial aid still see those kids as part of a family.
Any financial aid awards are based on what their parents make. And so that puts kids in a very tough bind because they can't just go and declare themselves independent from their parents.
Which brings us to another reason some parents don't save for college. They worry if they do put money away, their kids will get less financial aid. Not likely, O'Shaughnessy says. The federal formula most colleges use to calculate aid ignores assets up to a certain pretty high level. Say you manage to save $100,000 for your kid's education. O'Shaughnessy says your tuition bill is only going to be a few thousand dollars more than if you had no savings at all.
So obviously, someone who saved $100,000 for college is going to be so much better off than someone who didn't save a penny.
Of course, some parents don't save for college because they simply can't afford to, or they can't afford to save for college and retirement.
I think I had been worrying a lot more about saving for college than I was worrying about retirement. Well, I was worrying about both.
Tony Woods works for a utility company in Jacksonville, Florida. She'd been setting aside money for most of her 8-year-old daughter's life. Then she got some advice.
Remember, your children, when they graduate from college, are entering their highest earning years. And when you're retiring, you're entering your lowest earning years. So it was more important to save for retirement. We still save modestly for college, but the bulk of our savings go toward retirement.
That way, Woods figures she won't be a burden on her daughter. Plus, students can take out low-interest loans to pay for school. Not so easy with retirement. In Gloucester, Massachusetts, Layla Goodman had a different strategy. She didn't save money for retirement or her kids' college. When the children were young, she and her husband worked part-time so they could be around more.
And I think we got these really healthy kids who have a good sense of the world. And I feel like we invested in children, not in, you know, retirement accounts and college accounts.
They're paying the price now. With two kids in college, about half the family income is going toward tuition and room and board. In Perry, Georgia, Celestine Webb checks on her daughter's after-school plans.
What time do you have band practice today? Anybody have sectionals?
When Tesla starts college next year, Webb plans to help out now and then. And maybe it's just because her mom is in the room, but Tesla seems okay with the arrangement.
College is a stepping stone to real life, and my parents told me if I start to starve to death, they'll jump in. But other than that, I need to learn how to fend for myself. And I'm getting older now. I don't need to be babied anymore.
As for how she's going to pull it off, Tesla's got a plan. She's applying to a low-cost school in Idaho. She's counting on getting scholarships. And she's taking advanced placement classes in high school to get a jump on college credits while they're cheap. She wants to stay as far away from debt as she can. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace Money.
My husband buys a lottery ticket pretty much every week. A buck a pop, because we have just as much chance as anybody, right? Plenty of you out there think playing the lottery is stupid. A tax on people who are bad at math, says one post on our Facebook page. But I now know there is only one reason I haven't won yet. I'm playing in the wrong state.
Missouri Lottery, where the magic happens.
See, when you play the Missouri Lottery, apparently there's a chance you'll become a winner twice. That's what happened to 57-year-old Ernest Pullen. Back in June, he won $1 million on a scratch card. And 3 months later, another $2 million on another scratch card.
He's a lucky man.
Lucky and not fair. Don Ilvesacker teaches statistics at UCLA. Odds on the first winning ticket, 1 in 2.3 million. On the second, 1 in 100 million. But the good professor says, contrary to popular belief, winning is not that uncommon, even winning twice.
If you take all people that are playing in the United States, there's a lot of people. And that somebody wins twice is no longer quite so impressive. Moreover, if you say, well, within months, we don't know that a man hasn't been playing for 15 years and he's won twice. But it's about as common as, say, having a large rainstorm in the Northeast or something like that.
Then I want more rainstorms. Believe it or not, Ernest Pullen is not the luckiest guy in the world. No, that honor goes to 63-year-old Joan Ginther. She's won four, count them, four multi-million dollar jackpots in the last 17 years. Oh, and guess where she lives? Vegas. All right, now go to our Facebook page and tell us why you play the lottery or don't. It's facebook.com/marketplacemoney. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, what is a consumer to do when a company can't follow through on its promise?
So anyway, there was my thirst, and there was the A&W Root Beer. And so I went to the drive-thru, and I said, I'd like an A&W Root Beer, please. And the voice came over the microphone and said, I'm sorry, we're out of Root Beer. Could I get you something else?
The horrors. A chat with one of the brains behind Freakonomics. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Devin Robbins and Stephen Hoffman. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, committed to helping families across America pursue their college savings goals. You can learn more from your financial advisor or by visiting putnam.com/529.
American Public Media.